This is podcast number 124 for the Well-Educated Mother's Heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm talking about Monica, the mother of St. Augustine. As I continue highlighting persons of virtue, I now turn to a mother of great virtue whose influence on the history of the world is incalculable. The story takes place in some of the final years of the Roman Empire. For any of you who have had children grow up and depart from the ways you so carefully taught them, this story is one of hope. The story is found in the 1892 book Mothers of Great Men and Women by Laura Holloway, and an abridged version is found in Stories of Great Wives and Mothers. I'll be reading the abridged version for your sample. Those not familiar with ecclesiastical biography may need to be reminded that there were two St. Augustines who have left illustrious records in the annals of Christianity. One of them was a monk, who with 40 of his comrades was sent by Pope Gregory the Great to Christianize Britain, and who, landing on the coast of Kent, became the first Archbishop of Canterbury. But the other, and greater St. Augustine, who became after his conversion first a priest, and then Bishop of Hippo in Africa, is he whose mother has left an example of encouragement and benediction to the Christian mothers of all time. It is of her that we will now speak. St. Augustine was born under very different auspices from those of the Christians in the 19th century. Although Christianity had a large domain in the 4th century, and the Roman emperors were nominally Christians, yet the dissensions of Christians as to doctrine were so great, and their morals were so largely influenced by heathenism, that when the 3rd century closed, it seemed as if the salt of Christ's followers had lost its savor, and the light and sweetness of Jesus had deserted his professed disciples. A wholesale relapse into paganism seemed imminent, until St. Augustine lifted up the cross anew, and the plague was stayed. It is from his own Confessions, a work that has been translated again and again into all the languages of Europe, that we must gather the chief characteristics both of his mother and himself. His father, Patricius, was a heathen until within a few years of his death, which occurred when St. Augustine was a lad of 17. Monica's birth took place in 332, and she was raised in the Catholic faith, to which her parents steadily adhered. They were persons of genteel poverty who kept a small retinue of servants. One of these servants had nursed the father of Monica in his infancy and had obtained great authority in the household. She also cared for the future mother of St. Augustine, and it was through her restraining influence that Monica, after her marriage with Patricius, was enabled to live peaceably with her mother-in-law, who at first did all she could to prejudice the pagan husband against his unoffending Christian wife. Monica returned good for evil, and when her mother-in-law and the servants whispered against her, she so overcame by observance and persevering endurance and meekness that in the end these whispering tongues were silenced, and the wife and mother of Patricius lived together with a remarkable sweetness of mutual kindness. It is her illustrious son who tells us this, and who exclaims, "Such was she thyself, O God, her most inward instructor, teaching her in the school of the heart." I like that. "Such was she thyself, O God, her most inward instructor, teaching her in the school of the heart." We hear much in our time of the dangers and temptations of college life. Carthage, which was now a part of the Roman Empire, was the seat of the best learning of the time, and thither St. Augustine was sent in the year 371. Here he studied rhetoric, heathen literature, and philosophy. The scriptures appeared to him trivial when compared with the heathen classics, and especially with Cicero. Augustine remained at Carthage until his 19th year, at Monica's expense, his father having died 2 years before. It was a great consolation to Monica that her husband had become a Christian before his death, and that the last few years of their union had been peaceful and affectionate. It had not always been so. Patricius was a man of violent temper, who had abused, though he did not beat her, had impeded her religious doctrines, mocked at her high standard of virtue, and when Monica learned that her son Augustine, long given to immorality, had become the father of an illegitimate child, Patricius only laughed as though his sowing of wild oats were a matter of course. For the mother of this boy, Augustine entertained a sincere affection, although their relations, which continued for 15 years, were unlawful. Among those whom Monica interested in the mental and moral struggles of her son was a bishop who bade her leave Augustine alone and trust to prayers and time for the longed-for change, and who cheered her with the words, "It cannot be that the son of such tears should perish." There followed a hard period of sorrow and probation, both for the mother and the son. Monica believed in dreams. On one occasion, while she slept, there appeared to her a youth of shining aspect, who had, as it were, the face of an angel, and who whispered words of hope and consolation to her regarding the future conversion of her son. She herself seemed to be standing safely upon a bridge, which no storm could shake or waters of destruction reach. The radiant messenger assured her that where she was, there should her son be also. She awoke and beheld Augustine standing by her side. Through the long years of waiting that were yet to come, she drew comfort from the recollection of this vision and pondered it in her heart. Slowly and silently the change was wrought. Augustine had a dear friend, Nebridius. I had made one friend only too dear for me, and like myself in the fresh opening flower of youth. Nebridius was taken sick of a fever and lay unconscious and nigh unto death. He seemed to be getting better, but one day was attacked again with fever, and so departed. Augustine sorrowed long and bitterly for the loss of his one friend. Augustine at this time was occupied with the study of the beautiful, and, like Edmund Burke, wrote a book upon the subject. He dedicated it to a famous orator in Rome, and to Rome he himself set out from Carthage. He caught a sickness on his arrival, and while sick studied the scriptures with more attention. From Rome he set out for Milan, where he had received an appointment as a teacher of rhetoric. Augustine was now 30 years old. It was the year 385. Monica had for some time been kept anxious by the despondent tone of Augustine's letters, and at last resolved at all hazards to rejoin him at Rome. In those days the journey was a difficult one, especially for a woman. She was at this time residing at her native place, Tagaste. To meet the expenses of the journey, she had to sell her valuables. But she made her way to Carthage, from which her son had sailed 2 years before while she was waiting on the shore, and embarked. Hardly had the vessel sailed when a violent storm set in. The hearts of all on board sank with apprehension, and even the captain and sailors gave up all hope. But the faith which had enabled St. Paul to tranquilize a ship's company when he, too, was traveling Romeward, inspired poor Monica with courage. She cheered the sailors and restored their courage. She told them that though the waves of the sea were mighty and raged horribly, their Lord who ruled them was mighty and could still their raging. And so it was. They reached Civita Vecchia, and Monica hastened on to Rome, only to find that her son had left for Milan. The latter city is 200 leagues from Rome, and to reach it one must cross the Apennines. This did not scare her. The mountain passes had no more terrors for her than the stormy sea. So, after one day's rest, she set out for Milan, where the long desire of her soul was to be accomplished, and her son, after all his wanderings in the far country of sin and unbelief, was to be converted by the preaching of St. Ambrose, whom, said Monica, I shall ever think of as an angel of God. And receiving baptism in the spirit of a little child was to learn the eternal strain, Thou art the King of glory, O Christ. Except for St. Paul, Christianity had never gained a greater convert than St. Augustine, so far as intellect was concerned. Augustine stayed the septic process that was fast destroying the life of the Western Church. His marvelous gifts were transferred at once from the school of heathenism to the school of Christ, from the vain babbling of false philosophy to the service of absolute truth. His natural characteristics became sanctified and consecrated to higher uses. The eye that was so keen to note things beautiful in books and nature now saw the beauty of the city of God. Deep were his thoughts while yet a youth, and they grew deeper still when he discovered that God had created the soul and reason of man for his own abode, and that happiness and contentment can be found in him alone. The angel who wrestled in prayer for him and shed such tears of anguish was his mother, Monica. His confessions are full of the most grateful acknowledgments to God for what she had wrought for him. "Thy faithful one," he says, "weeping to thee for me, more than mothers weep the bodily death of their children, for discovered the death wherein I lay, and thou didst not despise her tears when, streaming down, they watered the ground in every place where she prayed." It was not until after 17 years of anxious wandering and doubt that the voice of enfranchisement was heard. The immediate circumstances are worth narrating. An old friend from Africa named Pontitianus was one of them that were of Caesar's household, being a military officer of the imperial court, but a fervent Christian, paid Augustine and his mother and his friend Alpius a visit at Milan. The old soldier of Christ and of Caesar had traveled much in Gaul, in Spain, in Italy, and in Egypt, and his talk was much upon religious houses which had taken rise from St. Antony in Alexandria and had spread to Africa. Augustine listened eagerly as the old man narrated that, while the emperor was at the circus, he had gone with 3 or 4 friends to walk in some gardens near the town. On their road, 2 of them went into a hermit's cell and found a manuscript life of St. Antony, which they began to read. "Tell me," said one to the other, "to what, after all, does our life tend? What do we seek or hope for? The favor of the emperor? But that is here today and gone tomorrow. Instead of that, if we will seek the favor of God, it is ours at once, now, and forever." When Pontitianus and the others joined them, the 2 men declared their purpose of devoting themselves henceforth to the service of God. Augustine, who was with his friend Alpius, was moved at the story, went into the garden, whither Alpius soon followed him. "What are we doing?" said Augustine. "Do you not hear? The ignorant, the unlearned, carry the kingdom of heaven by storm, while we, with our boasted science, grovel on the earth. Is it not a shame that we have not the courage to imitate them?" Abruptly quitting Alpius, he threw himself under a fig tree and began to weep in misery. Suddenly a child's voice seemed to reach him, singing and repeating the words, "Take and read." These words appeared to him as a revelation from heaven. Seizing a copy of the New Testament, he opened the passage. "Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envyings, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lusts thereof." Instantly, he says himself at the end of the sentence, "by a light, as it were, of serenity infused into my heart, all the darkness of doubt vanished away." Henceforth, until her death, a spiritual union was added to the natural affection subsisting between the now happy mother and her transformed son. Many were the conversations about high and heavenly things which they enjoyed together. "Son, for my part," said Monica, "I have no further delight in anything in this life. What do I hear any longer, or to what end I am here, I know not, now that my hopes in this world are accomplished. One thing there was for which I desired to linger for a while in this life, that I might see thee a true Christian before I died. My God hath now done this for me more abundantly, that I now see thee, despising earthly happiness, become his servant. What do I hear?" The shadows of life's evening were indeed closing around the mother of Augustine. About 5 days after this, she was taken with a fever and said to him, "Here shall you bury your mother." And when some lamented that she was about to die so far from her old home in Africa, she meekly answered, "Nothing is far to God, and I do not fear that he should know where to find me at the resurrection morning." "I closed her eyes," said her son, and there flowed a mighty sorrow into my heart. O my God, what comparison is there between the honor that I paid to her and her slavery for me? Being then forsaken of so great comfort in her, my soul was wounded, and behold, the corpse was carried to the burial. We went and returned without tears. And then, by little and little, I recovered my former thoughts of thy handmaid, her holy conversation toward thee, her holy tenderness and observance toward us, whereof I was suddenly deprived. Such was the mother of whom Augustine, to the close of his own life, declared, "It is to my mother that I owe everything. If I am thy child, O my God, it is because thou gavest me such a mother. If I prefer the truth to all other things, it is the point of my mother's teachings. If I did not long ago perish in sin and misery, it is because of the long and faithful tears with which she pleaded for me. By prayer and patience, she won her great son, Augustine, from unbelief and sensuality to that faith and self-consecration which made him a burning and shining light to all ages of the church and of the world. His influence upon Christian civilization can hardly be overestimated." Bye-bye. See you next time.